I'm Christine Carlson.
I'm Morris Wee.
And the title of this session is, I Hope It's a Boy. Can we raise children to be free of sex roles? Someone, Chuck Lutz, pointed out to us that on the board where all the classes are advertised, our session had been entitled, Can We Raise Children to be Free of Sex Rules? Someone had misread Charlie May's handwriting, and that was an interesting mistake to me. And as we talk, you'll see how kind of closely linked roles and rules can be. Yeah. So,
but if you think we're going to talk mainly about adolescent sexuality, that's probably not going to meet your expectations.
Right.
Well, the outline of our presentation is this. We'll start by claiming and trying to argue that children are treated differently according to their sexes, and that we shape them, our culture in general tends to shape them into certain roles according to their sex. This second section, we'll ask the question, why does it matter that this happens? The third section will be, what can we do about it? And then we would like to finish soon enough to have plenty of time for discussion among the group. I suppose especially in response to any of the parts of the presentation.
We'd like to give you four qualifiers. We're, as you can see, very new at this. Kai is 7 weeks old. And so we aren't presenting ourselves here as being experts. We're real beginning with this issue of parenting. We've thought about it a lot from the time, you know, when we were trying to make the decision about whether or not to have Kai and when and things like that, we started talking about parenting issues. So we've been discussing those for longer than 7 weeks. But we know that there's a wealth of experience in the room, and we'd like to draw on that in the discussion. And we don't mean to be putting ourselves up as the experts with it all figured out. The second is that we don't want to imply any accusations or any assumptions about what's best parenting versus worst parenting, or to make assumptions about how you've been parenting children or hope to parent children. We'd like this to be a discussion with several perspectives on it and many points of views represented. We also recognize that it's hard to perceive sometimes the biases in ourselves toward our children and their sex. And so to support some of what we're going to talk about, we've used a book that I'd like to show you that has been very important to us. It's called Growing Up Free by Letty Cotton Pogrieben. We're going to talk to Mary Schramm about ordering the book for the Holden Bookstore. We haven't done that yet. But this book has been helpful to us because it's loaded with statistics and studies, all written in a very accessible way, so that even if we don't perceive patterns in the way we're relating to Kai, these statistics show that the general trend of our society is in this direction or that direction. And so it's been a helpful book to us that way, to get some perspective, outside perspective, on how we're parenting Kai and what we're doing with him.
It gives us some ideas about what to look out for in ourselves when we read 85% of parents do this, even though we might not expect ourselves to fall into it.
And the fourth thing is that we realize that all of what we say has implications for our adult sex roles also. And we could get into a lot of discussion about adult sex roles. We'd like to focus this on raising children. So that's just another cautionary for us. I'd like to begin with a little scene that happened about 9 months ago. Maury and I had just told our parents that we were expecting a baby. And my mother came down to St. Paul, Minnesota, where Maury and I live, and went over one evening to visit two of her dear friends. That's a mother and a daughter who live together in St. Anthony Park in St. Paul. And part of the happy news that my mother shared with her two friends when she went there that evening was that Christine and Maury were expecting a baby in May. And the woman's first comment was, oh, I hope it's a boy. And that's where the title of this talk came from. My mother came home to relate this story to us, and we started to do some reflecting about that comment.
Yeah. We've heard that sort of comment many times before. I have 10 nieces and nephews, and some experiences hearing different people, not usually their parents, but different people talking about whether they were happy that it was a boy or a girl. And it does seem that there is virtually a worldwide preference for boys. Letty Cotton Pogrebin talks some about that in this book. But she also quotes some studies done in the United States in 1978, late enough we would think in the women's movement to have perhaps done away with some of those prejudices. For an only child, 90% of the men preferred a boy and 2/3 of the women. For a first child, 80% of all parents wanted a boy, and only 4% of the men or 10% of the women wanted a girl for a first child. Apparently, in families with more children, most people want a mix of boys and girls. But for children, families of three children, by far the majority preferred two boys and one girl rather than two girls and one boy. So that preference persists. Even before the baby's born, there is a preference for a boy rather than a girl.
And we've noticed that once the child is born, there's very quick sexual differentiation. This spring, in May and early June, after Kai was born, some of my relatives on either side of my family had showers for me and for Kai. And it was interesting to me, after these showers were over, to look at what kind of clothes Kai was given. And I noticed that he was given no print outfits. And he was given nothing pink. The outfits that he was given were either plain colors, all solids, mostly blue, or stripes. And that seemed to be the style of clothing that women at showers, the kind of clothing that women would buy for a boy baby. And because I knew that if Kai were a girl, he'd get a lot of pink things and a lot of prints. That seems to be for girls. And so right away, just in the clothing at the shower for this little two-week-old baby, there was what I understood to be sexual differentiation that way.
Christine?
Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, I know.
Still doing it.
Yeah, that's right. We haven't outgrown that one yet.
Yeah. Kai's we're so
wearing
conditioned.
Pink. We dressed Kai in a pink outfit for today, but we didn't look at what we were wearing. Oh, I love it. Another present that Kai was given was a baseball cap, for an infant baseball cap, and on the front of it was written Baby Slugger. And I was horrified by that, and that one I threw away because it seemed to me so violent that here we were asking this two-week-old infant to go out there and slug it out, you know, be a real slugger. And maybe I was reading that too literally. It's just a baseball cap, and, you know, he should just be into sports a little bit. But I thought that was such a violent thing for a little two-week-old baby to be wearing. And that was a boy present. No little girl would have gotten that present, I don't think. Another thing that I noticed in the clothes, he got two outfits, one with a fake fly in it, two with fake flies in it. And there is no use for that, but right away, you know, he's being dressed in male clothing and not in sort of baby clothing. So that was interesting to me to note, the sexual differentiation that occurred right away, the minute that he was born, and we knew that it was a boy.
Letty Pogrebin cites several studies that back up that kind of observation, too. Very early in children's lives, their parents and other adults start observing in them behaviors that are seen to be male or female behaviors. They did a study of children who, at the age of 24 hours, asking their fathers to describe their activity. The hospital took a sample of children and determined that there was no distinguishable differences. There were no differences between the boys and the girls, and they asked the fathers to describe them. The fathers saw their sons as firmer, more alert, I'm quoting now, better coordinated and stronger than the girls, who were seen as finer featured, more awkward, more inattentive, and weaker. In other words, as soon as they hear the gender of the child, people begin to make some assumptions about their activities, and they look at the same kinds of, same size and type of baby and same activity, and they see different things in it because they know the sex. There was another study done at the age of 3 months where they asked parents to play with three-month-old children, and they were given a football, a doll, and a neutral toy, a flexible ring, to play with the child with. And some were told what the sex was, and some were not told what the sex the child was. Those that didn't know the sex said they were uncomfortable, they didn't quite know what to do. They tended to take the neutral toy, the flexible ring, and play with it. If they were told it was a girl, they invariably gave the girl the doll. And they played differently with these children according to the sex. Didn't go into detail about how differently they played. But when asked to guess the sex of the child, those that had not been told, the majority guessed wrong. I don't know what that means. I would think that it would be 50-50, but they chose a toy according to the sex that they thought the child was. Excuse me, I have to explain. The same child was dressed in different sex clothes, so they...
Adam and Beth, they named the child.
Yeah. They did another Adam and Beth experiment with the same child at the age of 6 months, with a fish, a doll, and a train, with the same results. When the child was named Adam, the child was given a train. When the child was named Beth, the child was given a doll by these adults. And the importance of that, seems to me, is that those kinds of training can become self-fulfilling. After you've done this for a while, the boys are likely to prefer trains and the girls are likely to prefer dolls, and they learn to work with those things. So that we can create the kinds of expectations in our children that we have. We can shape them in that image, even though they don't have necessarily any intrinsic qualities that may guide them in that way. When children get a little bit older, they begin to pick up these signals and consciously differentiate themselves according to their sex. And it seems to me, working with my experience, with a little guidance from this book, which I thought was so often accurate, that one of the main requirements for a young boy is to be unlike a girl. That is one of the strongest messages that we get as young boys. I had playmates, girl playmates, before I went to school, but once I got to school, I learned that I was not supposed to like girls, and I said I didn't like them, and I didn't play with them. When I was in elementary school, my acceptance in my peer group was determined according to athletics. If I was a good athlete, I was accepted. Had nothing to do with academics, and I wouldn't have worked at that at all, I don't think, if it hadn't been for the influence of my family, which encouraged me a great deal in that way. But really, I tended to downplay my academic abilities, because they did not help distinguish me. I'm guessing at the motive now. They did not help distinguish me from girls. My athletic ability did, because girls didn't do those things. Not as well, I suppose, as men did. And by the time I got into high school, girls were exempt from athletics when I was in high school. And I continued to define myself and to get acceptance in my peer group primarily through athletics. The language of our society also clarifies that kind of difference. When I was in high school, the most derogatory term that we boys used among each other for one another was woman. You woman, we said. Mother was another one. That's more common, but woman was really the one I remember best. If you think of other derogatory terms for boys, they are terms that associate them with women, like sissy, effeminate, girlish, womanish. Those are very derogatory terms. Because boys, more than anything else, are supposed to be unlike girls. And they work hard to be different. They're told not to cry like a girl. I was trying to remember specific incidents of that, and I can't. I'm quite sure that I was told on several occasions not to cry like a girl, by my parents, by my father in particular, but I can't remember a specific time. I do remember the one incident, and it's amazing to me that such a trivial incident would stick with me so long. But it was a time when I was probably in junior high school, a little self-conscious about myself and my sexuality. I was putting on a sport coat to go to church, and I got the first sleeve on this side, and then I tried to get my arm in the other sleeve, and I took my arm like this and I put it in, and my father saw me struggling to get the arm in there, said, "Don't do it like that. Do it like this." He took the coat off. He said, "You put your arm back here." He said, "Girls put on their coat like this. You put your arm, you stretch it out and put it in back there," which is how I've always put on a coat since.
I'm always going like this.
But I remember being very hurt by that, first of all, that I did this like a girl. And I think part of me sensed that it was inappropriate of my father to make that claim, to say that, that it really shouldn't have mattered. But I was deeply hurt by it, and I've remembered that incident ever since. And in fact, every time I put on a coat, I remember it.
Maury, do you remember carrying books? There was a way boys were to carry books.
Yes.
Yeah. On the hip. Right. Yeah. Boys carry them on the hip down here. Yeah. Girls carry them.
Besides
up
those things.
Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it?
The thing I noticed about sexual differentiation for girls growing up, or that I noticed looking back on it, is that girls are freer. We can be more androgynous. We can be more do girl things and boy things. Little girls can wear blue as well as pink. Little girls can dress in slacks as well as dresses. Little girls can play. I was great at kickball. That was one of my great sports in second and third grade. But I could also, play dolls or play house or play mommy. As a young girl, I had a lot of options to be like a girl or like a boy. And when I was young, I was a real tomboy. I was athletic and liked to do things outside in sports. And it was okay to be a tomboy. That's what we were called. But that was all right. When I started running into troubles was around junior high in seventh and eighth grades, when it became important to girls in my peer group to start attracting men or males. And then it became important for girls to become other than males. Up until that time, it was okay for us to be like girls and like boys. But in about seventh or eighth grade, when we hit that junior high time, when the way we wore our hair and curled it and makeup and stuff like that started to become real important, a lot to attract males. And then it became important for us to become feminine, female, like a girl at that point. And so I think women are still a little freer to be more androgynous than men. I can wear pants and dresses, men can't. But in junior high, I remember it being very important to be very feminine and very much like a girl. The question we'd like to ask next is, why does any of this matter? That's a brief introduction to sexual differentiation as we see it in our culture.
One of the important results, I think, of this kind of phenomenon is that women tend to fear success in our culture because it may threaten men, it may make them less attractive to men, and they have discovered at some point that they wish to be attractive to men. This has been documented by a number of studies. I know at Radcliffe and Wellesley College, they've done studies that have documented this fear of success, both academic success, financial success, that women often at the brink of major breakthroughs will back off. I was reading in here an example of a woman who worked for a major corporation and was highly successful in advertising and continually turned down promotions so as not to have a higher salary than her husband, until finally her husband died, at which point she was made vice president and her salary quadrupled.
That was a plural company.
The more immediate example for me is my niece, who grew up when she was young, was very bright, did a lot of writing, creative writing, and did very well in school and seemed to enjoy it. But when she reached high school, she changed her interests. She became a cheerleader. She started to giggle a lot, to just quit working on academic work entirely, and make boyfriends, I guess. I don't know if she had to do that to have boyfriends, but you sure could see this fairly radical change in her, which I don't think is quite turned around yet. There's a counterpart for this to this fear of success on the part of women, and it's the fear of failure on the part of men. I don't have as clear an example to give you. There's the kind of classic image of the Wall Street bankers jumping out of the windows when the stock market crashes. There is an assumption that men will continue to climb some ladder of professional success. And I do think there is a real expectation of that, and then going with that, always the fear that they might not make the next rung. I feel that pressure in myself quite often.
The second reason we think it matters is that this such strong sexual differentiation, I think, ends up creating a dislike between men and women. That when we're little, you know, boy germs, yuck, and girl and boys don't want to be like girls, that doesn't go away. That as we get older and older, this dislike between women and men continues. And it also creates then a hierarchy of relationship. Boys are raised in a way to think that they're better than girls, and girls are trained or raised by our culture to be subordinate, to think they're less good than boys. And when we finally are grown up, then we have a hierarchy of relationship where men are better than women, and we've been trained into those roles. Men to think of themselves as being above women, better than women, and women to think of ourselves as less good than men, and to be below men in a hierarchical kind of relationship that way. A third reason that it matters, I think, is that I've seen in myself and in other people is the destructiveness of sexual differentiation in individual lives. And I was very struck recently by an interview that I saw on television of a ballet dancer with a New York ballet company. And he was talking about what it was like to grow up as a little boy in a small town in Minnesota, being a very talented dancer. He was ridiculed by boys and girls alike, but particularly what affected him was the ridicule that he experienced from his male boy peer group. He was lonely, isolated. He said he never really met anyone like himself until he finally left Minnesota at the age of 18 and moved to New York to try to join a ballet company there. And for 18 years, this male, because he was interested in something that's supposedly feminine in our culture, had been mistreated. And he used words like destroyed and the kind of struggle that he had to just survive with his talent and interest, because he was male and happened to be a dancer. So that kind of destructiveness is another reason for us that this sexual differentiation matters.
I think what we all want for our children and for all children is the freedom to develop the unique selves that they are, and to become, if they are good dancers, to work on that and become great dancers, to become all that they are as daughters and sons of God. And so often I think by limiting what are areas that men and women can potentially grow in, we curtail that possibility. We really eliminate some of the growth that might be part of our experience if we were to develop as freely and as fully as we could.
So we'd like to consider briefly what can we do given this situation in our culture. And first, the first thing that occurs to me is that we can encourage our children to be themselves first and not to be a boy first or a girl first. Certainly our sex is very integral to who we are as a person, but it's one of many things that I am. I'm a woman, I was a girl, I'm also a musician, I like to read, I like to do needlework, I'm athletic, I'm white, I'm Norwegian in heritage, I'm all of these things, and all of those come together to create me, uniquely who I am. And that's what we can encourage our children to discover, those unique things about themselves, and to become all of those things, and not always have this thing hanging over my head that, oh, if I'm not a girl or a woman, it's a terrible thing, or if I'm not a boy, that's what I need to be first.
We can also affirm and, in fact, insist that both sexes are good and worthy, that neither sex is superior to the other, that there isn't anything wrong with the other sex, and that it's good to be a woman, it's good to be a man, to be a boy, to be a girl. And that sounds simple enough, but I think it needs to be heard.
And I didn't realize how difficult or hard that was, or what a taboo that was, until after Kai was born. We had talked earlier about whether or not he would wear pink as well as blue, those colors, you know. And we had decided that he would wear pink as well as blue. But when it came to putting a pink outfit on him and taking him out in public in that outfit, the kind of fear that the idea of doing that aroused in me was tremendous. And I thought, you know, oh, Christine, you've dealt with these issues forever, and where is this fear coming from? But I realized what a strong taboo it was in our culture, that boys would be like girls. And it was really strong in me when I faced that pink outfit and Kai, and we were going to go to church, you know, because people would ask, oh, it's a girl, she's wearing pink, and then I would have to say, no, it's a boy, and what would those people think? That was really a profound moment for me when I realized the strength of that taboo, even in myself.
not
in me.
Oh. I think we, sure, this may sound extreme, but I think we can begin at least with the assumption that all behavior that is appropriate for one sex is appropriate for the other. Then if we have some kind of proof that that's wrong, maybe we'd want to reconsider. But I think we could begin with that assumption, that if it's appropriate for one sex to go play in the mud, it's appropriate for the other.
And just as a cautionary here, I'd like to add that what we're not advocating is some mush, unisex, that certainly being a boy or being a girl, that's a creation of God, and that's a marvelous thing to be, each of us different in that way from one another. But what we're trying to avoid with this talk and our ideas in the discussion afterwards is sexist treatment of that, or sexist use of our sexual differentiation. And by that we mean that there's an assumption or an attitude that one sex is better than another, that in our differentness we're not better or worse than one another, but being mutual and equal with one another, there's blessedness in that and goodness in that.
Okay. I feel too that I would call sexist attitudes that insist that males must fit in this territory and females must fit in that territory, even if one is not seen as superior to the other, but that necessarily limits people to half the world. I would call that sexist too. Another idea that we are going to try, that we suggest as a possible response to this, is called by Letty Pogrebin parity parenting. That is, parenting with equality in amount status and character. And we've been trying to do this and found it very difficult.
Parity, yeah. Term, when I first heard it, I didn't know what it was, but it's parity, P-A-R-I-T-Y. I think she likes it, likes it because it's alliterative, parity, right. Parenting. Yeah. You could say egalitarian parenting, I suppose.
Not the price of corn.
No. Thank you, Chuck. I know. That's the confusing part about that term, I think. We've discovered with ourselves and among our friends how difficult this is to pull off. Many of our friends and we have been together for, Maureen and I have been married for 8 years. Many of our friends are in the same situation. In our 20s, we were pursuing vocational directions, getting professional degrees or getting ourselves established in some form of work.
Which some of us are still pursuing
yes.
in our 30s.
And now that we're 30, in our mid-30s, we're beginning to consider family and indeed having children. What we've seen among our friends who aided us in this endeavor is that they had worked really well and struggled hard to establish egalitarian marriages, where they worked really well together as husband and wife and had broken down sex roles for themselves and were more themselves in this marriage than man and woman or husband and wife. And we've noticed that when a child comes, a lot of that tends to fall apart. And part of this is due, I think, to economic conditions and to the policies of our institutions. Women get maternity leaves, men don't get paternity leaves. And so among our friends who have had babies, the woman has been given 6 months leave, and the husband has been lucky if he's gotten a week. We have one friend, Tom Grady, who got 3 weeks, but that was rare. Otherwise, fathers are having to go off to work every day, and the mothers are the ones staying home with the children. And no matter how hard they work at it, it's still the mother's baby on the whole, just because of the time that the woman is ending up spending with the child compared to the time that the man can spend with the child. And so there's some anger that's being articulated among our friends right now about this unfair policy that women get maternity leaves, but men don't get paternity leaves, because they don't then get a chance to establish themselves as fathers in an equal way to the way that women get to establish themselves as mothers.
I think there are other reasons for that too. I think that having a child so radically changes your family and puts so much pressure all of a sudden on the relationship that you don't have the time and the energy to reassess everything, and you easily slip back into the patterns that you've seen. Mm-hmm. The patterns you've seen are your parents' patterns, and they're probably something different than you might have wanted to do. And we're all conditioned by the patterns we've grown up with, and when you don't have the energy or the time to try working out something new, I think it's quite easy to fall back into those. I think that it's particularly difficult for men to be actively involved in parenting children for several reasons. The simplest and most profound for me is that when I was growing up, I was never given a doll. Playing with dolls, playing house, is the kind of thing that exercises your imagination to think about what it's going to be like to be a parent. There aren't any classes in parenting. So that when you do suddenly find yourself in this situation, you've got nothing to go on except the things you've observed and the things you've imagined. And I feel like that whole imaginative life of carrying around a doll and dressing it and thinking about what it would be like to be a parent was reserved for girls in my generation anyway. At least I didn't get it. And I'm sorry about that. It's been hard for me to get used to the idea. We don't get much reinforcement either, even today, for being fathers. Christine and Kai have been invited to 2 baby showers since he was born, to which I wasn't invited. Showers were for Kai, and those are kind of celebrations where you celebrate the new child and you give lots of reinforcement to the parent. But it's the mother who gets that reinforcement. And I was sitting at home wishing I was there getting some ideas from all the women who were there giving them to Christine.
And don't go to shower. The others go to showers too. Are
yeah, all women. Yeah, all right. Women,
yeah, that's right.
Yeah, they're just not for
me. Gifts.
Right. Yeah. Though I did read in Ms. Magazine about a shower given by men for a new father. All men. Yeah.
They had a barbecue.
I would love it if some friend of mine had enough imagination to do that. Of course, maybe the biggest impediment for men is that they can't breastfeed. And breastfeeding gives Christine probably 5 hours a day of intimate contact with Kai, of flesh-to-flesh intimacy that is hard for me to equal if I wanted to be a parity parent and come up with equal time. And I know that's a real impediment. I'm not going to have exactly that kind of relationship with Kai, and I can't. In order to compensate for that, we've tried some things that we'll get to in a minute. But I know that's one of the fundamental differences that is going to make for real differentiation in the fathering and mothering. Pogrebin quotes a well-known study in here that says fathers in this study spent on an average 38 seconds a day with their infant children. I could hardly believe that. 38 seconds a day. Infants are just given over to the mothers. Fathers just get to dandle them on the knee for a few seconds. As soon as they start to cry, you can go like that with them again. And with that kind of background, it's very difficult to come up with the 12 hours a day, or let's say 5 waking hours, to equal the 5 hours of breastfeeding that Christine has with Kai. If you just think about the difference between the words fathering and mothering, the meaning of the word to father, which is to beget, you know, it happens back then and it's pretty much over, and the meaning of the word to mother, which is a sense of continuous nurturance. I think you have a sense of how our culture has traditionally looked at this, especially with respect to young children.
I have experienced some problems as a woman also trying to work with Maury to be parity parents. And they've been two ones that I can think of specifically. I just graduated from the seminary. I'm in the process of waiting for a call to a church in the Twin Cities, I hope. And I have had to struggle with a lot of guilt about working outside the home in addition to being Kai's mother and being at home. The family I grew up in, my mother, when I was born, I'm the oldest, she stayed home and took care of me and raised 3 younger daughters also. And my model is that good parenting means that the mother is home full time and the father is home when he can be home. And my father was good at making time with us, but the mother's role is in the home with the children. And so I have been struggling with guilt about pursuing a career as well as being a mother, and that's going to ruin my child, or Kai's going to grow up in a way I wouldn't want him to grow up because I'm not going to be home all the time with him. All of that stuff that I'm struggling with right now, guilt about wanting both. And I believe that I can have both, but I'm feeling some guilt with that. Another thing that I've struggled with once in a while is letting go of Kai and letting Maury take him and play with him and be with him, and my just leaving them together and going out for a walk or going to talk to a friend or going to play the piano or do some needlework and just letting the two of them be alone together for 4 or 5 hours. Because also my message is, Christine, you're supposed to be with that baby all the time. That baby is your primary task. And in order to be parity parents, mothers can't be hovering over fathers saying, no, don't do it that way, do it this way, or criticizing clothes that Maury puts on Kai in the morning versus what I would have put on him, or the way Maury deals with diaper rash versus the way I deal with diaper rash. All these interesting topics that, if you're not parents already, they'll become fascinating to you once you have a baby. But for there to be real parity parenting, this baby needs to be as much Maury's as it is mine. And I've been struggling in some ways with letting go of that child and letting go of Kai and having him be Maury's too.
There was a guest in the village last week, just for a few days, who was a specialist in fathering and infancy. And he said he, and in his community, he arranged a support group for fathers with young children. And he got them to come together for 2.5 hour stretches once a week with their children. And the first time they met, they got together in this room, they locked the doors, and before they were done, several mothers were there beating on the windows wondering how their children were doing. It is hard to let them go. And for these fathers, this was for many of them the first time they had been with the child that long apart from the mother. I would say the same is true for me at this point. Maybe 2.5, 3 hours is the most. Then I start getting nervous, and Kai starts getting nervous.
Yeah. So, how's he doing?
Yeah. Well, we're trying a few things to do our best anyway. We started by trying to involve me in the pregnancy as much as possible. We talk about it that way. We'd say, we're expecting. I came to all the prenatal visits at the hospital, and I found out what was going on inside Christine, and I was there to talk to the midwives and hear about it and be in on it as much as I could. I had sympathetic pains in my stomach when Christine was sick. Or I pretended I did. When it came time for the birth, we went to some classes, birthing classes beforehand too, and we were lucky to be involved with a program that allowed me to stay in the hospital overnight in the same hospital room with Christine and Kai for the whole time she was there. So we had 3 days together with full time with Kai right after he was born, and Christine was beat and tired during that time, and I got in on a lot of the care for Kai in those first days, which was very important, I think, for me. And that experience is much of what our session tomorrow is going to be about, which we call, I think, birth as second honeymoon. To give me a chance to get some intimacy time with Kai, we've decided that I will change Kai's diapers every time, and I will get to bathe Kai every time. There are going to be exceptions to this. There may be exceptions to feeding too, if Kai learns to take a bottle at some point, if there's some need for it. But as it stands now, Christine's doing all the feeding, I'm doing all the changing and bathing, and I love it. I just love it. It's my time to be touching him and talking to him and looking at him and having fun. So.
And I panic when I'm alone with him and he poops. I don't know what to do. So, I'm learning. This is my expert here. There are a couple things that I've been trying to do too. Mostly to help me let go of Kai, I've been suggesting that Maury carry Kai in the snuggly and hold him, and giving Kai up to Maury. That's been my main task in all of this, to keep reminding myself to do that. And it made me feel that maybe we were having some success with that when there was a woman, Fritzi, I don't know if you knew her, she was in the village last week, and she saw me one time toward the end of her visit coming out of Chalet 3 where we've been staying. And she looked at me and she said, "Christine, something's wrong." And I said, "You know, what's going on?" And she said, "You're supposed to have Kai." And she said, "I've been keeping track of you, and every time I see Maury and he doesn't have Kai, you have Kai. And when I see, and then the next time you will..." Oh, I'm getting this mixed
up. I think
up.
She said, "Every time she saw me, I had Kai, and every time she saw you, you had Kai." And she just, the
right.
Last person she had seen was me, and she was
right.
Ready to see
and
you.
And so I was supposed to have Kai that time. Anyway, what she was meaning was we were sharing him very equally, and it was my turn to have had Kai at that point, and I didn't have Kai. So I can't say it as well as she said it, obviously, but that made me feel that, to Fritzi at least, we were doing some pretty good sharing. But again, we feel very beginning in this. We are just at the ground floor. Many of you have much more experience than we do and have tried other things than we have. This is a hard thing in a way. We don't have a lot of models for this. We're making the way as we go. But it's been a very exciting time for us and a time to get to know whole new dimensions of one another in this journey of parenting. Before we open it up for discussion, I'd like to conclude that with just a statement, I guess, that we don't, however, want to be naive about our social pressures and think that we can raise Kai in this ideal kind of non-sexist world. We recognize that social pressures are really strong. We see that in the lives of our nieces and nephews. And I guess what we're hoping is that our home can be a haven for Kai and for any other children that we would have, a haven that's free of some of the social pressures that the child is experiencing outside the home, and a haven where Kai can learn to deal with those social pressures that he's experiencing outside. So now we'd like to talk with you about all of this and get your ideas, and I might have to nurse Kai.
Let me try.
Yeah.
I just want to say that I have heard of one or two companies who are getting father's leaves.
Yeah.
That's beginning. The Minneapolis Star Tribune is beginning that now, I know.
But in Sweden, where such leaves are available, they cannot take them. Is
that right?
Yeah. Which is an interesting phenomenon. It's much looser there.
Mm-hmm. What are you talking about? Maybe?
Yeah, speak up, please, so that.
Well, now that I'm going to be challenged, I'm not sure I can come up with statistics, but I studied it.
I'm not challenging you. I just want to hear what you're saying.
In Sweden, where men are allowed to turn to leaves, they are not taken.
I was going to try to nurse him, but...
And also with the... Christine, you were mentioning the feelings of guilt about being working and parenting at the same time.
Yeah.
There are a lot of women who have chosen to be full-time mothers, if you want to call it that. Anyway, spending not having an official job in the outside world and taking care of their children, who are having to deal with guilt. In just the opposite direction.
Yeah, that's right.
With the feeling that to be a liberated woman, you've got to have a job in addition. And I think that is sad.
Yeah.
Then the last thing I wanted to mention is just something that my mother mentioned to me. My parents were here a couple weeks ago. And it had to do with this thing about dolls. There are three boys who came first in the family, and three girls came last. To all six of us, they offered dolls to play with. We boys, we were too young to have gotten all this acculturation to say that we're not supposed to be interested in dolls. And we were not interested in them.
Mm-hmm.
The girls took to them immediately. I don't know that that's universal, but I think that there may be some national affinities here that are more than just a frustration.
Yeah, those are really fine observations, I think, and I thank you for offering them, because those were limitations in my perspective. I do want a career and parenting. And so that's what I spoke out of, but I think that your observation about women's guilt for staying home to be full-time homemakers is a very fine one. And another option that we haven't discussed is men staying home full-time to be house husbands, I guess they call them, or homemakers at home.
My brother's best friend in Spokane is a house husband.
That's another option.
That's great.
And I think your observation about the orthodoxy or the rigidity of the newly liberated parents is very true, too. And I guess the other thing that I worry about with that is using my child to be a cause.
Yeah.
And I think that that can be very destructive to Kai. I don't want him to have to bear the burden of his mother's and father's causes, sort of. So I like the freedom that you're asking for in your observation. I really support that. Yeah?
I'd like to say first that I think you're blessed in one sense of being born in this generation where practices have liberalized to a great extent. When our children, our first children were born, my wife went to the hospital and the staff said, you know, that's nice, we'll call you, go home.
Yeah.
And the father was a person that was not necessarily wanted anywhere around to confuse the issue.
Yeah.
So I think in today's society, being able to participate in the joy of the birth is really a blessing. I, by the way, have been able to do that with a later child, and I really liked it. But my wife and I had a role reversal during a good bit of our life. While I was going to college, my wife worked nights, and I had the responsibility of the family, raised the daughters that we had. To this day, they still, you know, complain about Dad's cooking. And I don't look back too favorably on the role reversal. What I'm leading up to is I think that you mentioned in your discussion about trying, about preconceived notions that people have. You know, Dad should be out earning a living, doing this, whatever. Mom should be home fixing food and keeping care of the kids. And we may try in our own household to be very objective about it, to make certain that our children are sensitive and caring. That's the important thing, not whether they're a baseball player or a housewife or whatever the role that they want to assume later on. But we have to recognize that the real pressure that they face is not from us. It's from their peer group.
Yeah.
You mentioned the dancer.
Mm-hmm.
His peer group undoubtedly did not consider dancing as a viable entity for a male expression,
mm-hmm.
and therefore he was outcast.
Yeah.
In closing, as a young man here observed, my mother said I was 7 before I gave up my doll.
Well, there's the bell. Any of you who want to make it to dinner are certainly welcome to leave, and we'll stay and keep talking as long as anyone wants to stay.